You're listening to Saxon's Creed Radio Show. I'm David James, and I'm your host. Greetings to all the tribes of Israel who are the Anglo-Saxon, Celtic, Scandinavian, and Nordic peoples, our brothers and sisters around the world. It's nice to be back with you today, ladies and gentlemen. It's nice to know that we have a president, a new president, although I can't say what he will do. I can't say if he will keep his promises, but I'm certainly hoping so. As much of you, are as well. One thing that really aggravates me across this nation is that we have a lot of women governors. And to me, men are the natural leaders. It shouldn't be this way. It is an upside-down perversion of what the world should be. So it's a good thing that we don't have a Jewess named Hillary Clinton as president. Because we see what Merkel's doing over there. And we see what these women governors are doing. They're destroying their states. So it's time for men to take back the power. That's just something I've realized, is that women are wielding a power of sorts. The feminists told them to use your sexuality as a power over men. I've realized just recently that there's only one way to get that power back, is to not give them any power. Just don't allow them to have that power over you. The power of sexuality. Basically, if they're going to use it as a weapon against you, and a weapon to control you, and a weapon to gain advantage over you, that should turn you off. That should make you, I'm turned off by the perversion of women today that are not Yahweh's women. I'm not looking to have a boyfriend. I'm looking to have a girlfriend. And if I wanted to date a man, which is ridiculous, you could just go out with these women now. Because they all want to be men. There's nothing more of a turnoff to me than to see a woman speak as a man and try to act as a man. I love feminine women who are dainty, who are submissive, who know their place where Yahweh has put them. I don't want to date a woman. Would you? The more I see of these women, the more I realize, I don't care if they're beautiful or not, it just seems to me that they are the enemy. Now, I know that some of you will get upset because you think I'm talking about you. If the shoe fits, wear it. But if you're a woman of Yahweh and you are a true woman and you act as a woman of Yahweh, I'm not speaking about you. I simply will not, in the same way as I won't give people jurisdiction I will not give women jurisdiction or give them the ability to have the power over me. I've made that decision. I'll be single for the rest of my life. I don't care. I was once married. I will not give them the power over me. Plain and simple. And it's a shame that it is the way it is. You see, these aren't Yahweh's creations. They are tainted creations, just like these fairy men out there are tainted creations of Yahweh. Those aren't men. It's up to you, ladies and gentlemen. It's up to you, men, to stand up and be men and take the power back. The easiest way to do that is not allow them to have the power over you. Too many men are like lapdogs. Whatever these women say, they'll do. It's time now. You know, and this is what the women really want. They want you to be men. They want you to take control. So you really have a duty to not only the kingdom and not only your country, but you have a duty to yourself. I mean, ultimately to Yahweh. It's time to stand up and be a man. You see, if you won't stand up and be a man, these women will. That's all I really have to say about that subject. Let's go on to this book that we've been studying. The Mystery of the Serpent, Part 3. Ladies and gentlemen, this has been an eye-opening experience. I know you must be excited to get to this next part here. Let's continue where I left off on page 16. In Numbers 21:6 and Deuteronomy 8:15 are fiery serpents. That word, fiery, in the Hebraic is seraph. It means burning, blazing. Sometimes it is seraphim. So it means something hot. That word serpent is nakash and is written without bars and dots under the last two characters. Written thus, and by close study of the chapters, one observes that the serpent is an enchanter, something which enchanted the people. In Deuteronomy 8:15, the Hebraic for the word scorpion is akrab. Very interesting. A-Q-R-A-B, which is just an ordinary scorpion. Yet the serpents are not snakes. It holds for Exodus 21:6-7. What, then, are the fiery serpents sent by God to bite and kill the people? That word fiery as a seraph and the serpents as nakash, or enchanter, are the clues proving the fiery serpents are heat waves caused by the sun radiating from the dry ground, which, when observed from a distance, formed into shimmering, undulating mirages, seraphim. This is going to get very interesting, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you're listening. That unfamiliar spectacle enchanted nakash are Israelite progenitors, and they received sunstroke and were dangerously blistered by the tremendous summer heat after the people spoke against God and Moses. and refused to get in the shade of their tents. Moses warned them to keep in the shade during the heat of the day, but the stiff-necked people ignored him and remained outdoors to look at the enchanting mirages, constantly changing from one spectacle to another. Many of the people died from sunstroke and severe sunburn. Those not dying yet were weakened with high fever, appealed to Moses to save them. He could have used his power and cured them, but it would have been useless. They were so rebellious that as soon as they had been cured, they would again have defied him. To convince them, he knew what he was talking about and let them suffer and learn the hard way. They would not rely on him for anything when the going got tough. Without something to look out, to look at and remind them of Moses' warning to remain in the shade during the heat of day, they would go their headlong way and continue exposing themselves to sunstroke and sunburn while declaring they were rugged enough not to be hurt. Therefore, in Numbers 21:19 is the record where Moses installed a brass serpent on a pole in the center of the camp. That word serpent is nakash in the original. Moses, however, did not install it for the people to worship and appeal to cure snake bite, as many Christian clergymen have preached, or ignored it because their idea of it was that of an idol. Now, idol worship is forbidden by God. To preach it as an idol, which God told Moses to install, would be contrary to his word. Therefore, that partition of our scriptures is ignored by many clergymen. The cults have seized hold of that serpent and declare our Israelite progenitors worshipped the Ophidian God, who is Satan, symbolizes the serpent of divine wisdom, and our God gave approval. Inasmuch as God told Moses to set it up, the Ophites declare the tribal God of Israel knows Satan is more powerful than he. They wish. So another cult, the Ophidian cult. Unbelievable. God, however, never told Moses to install an image of the Ophite devil. In Numbers 21:8 is where he tells Moses to install the fiery serpent. That serpent is a nakash, and it means an enchanter in the original Hebraic text. The word fiery is seraphim. What then is that serpent? It is nothing more than a flat or concave polished brass disc to serve as a thermometer installed in the middle of the camp so that it could be observed by any angle. When it became hot in the sun and its temperature increased as the sun approached the zenith, heat waves, seraphim, began radiating from it. At the maximum temperature, the radiation would be so intense, one looking at it would see a spectacle as though the radiated heat was water pouring in every direction, similar to water flowing down the outer surface of a glass window pane, while one looks at it from inside the room. When our progenitors saw that fiery radiation, it was a solemn warning that the temperature out in the sun rays was too intense, and they had better get in their tents and remain until the heat slacked off in the late afternoon. That time was indicated when the brass enchanter ceased radiating. Those formerly receiving minor sunstroke and sunburn were cured by remaining in their tents. I do not know how high the temperature rises in the Arabian desert in summer, but Mr. W.B. Seabrook, in his book, Adventures in Arabia, says it is so severe that one will even blister in the shade of a moving motor car. To prevent it, it is necessary for white men to wear heavy woolen clothes. He says he preferred being parboiled that way rather than roasted with light summer clothes on. On the plains of Cambodia, French Indochina, I have experienced during the dry season a temperature rise to 150 degrees Fahrenheit in the shade. In the open sun rays, the temperature is so intense, the exposure to it is similar to one walking in an open fire and flaming fiery serpents, seraphim, are very much alive and active on the distant landscape. They are mirages produced by heat waves rising from the dry ground. They form in various shapes. Occasionally, they seem to be a waterfall or cataract, except the water falls upward. On other occasions, they seem to be a lake of shimmering silver. Other times, they seem to be millions of headless white snakes chasing one another over the landscape. Occasionally, one seems to see a high wave of shimmering, melting glass rapidly approaching. There still lingers in Anglo-Saxondom an old saying that the sun heat waves are lazy Lawrence. Listen to this, folks. I'm going to say this again. There still lingers in Anglo-Saxondom an old saying that the sun heat waves are lazy Lawrence. Obviously, the expression has come down from our progenitors. 40 years of probation in the Arabian and Sinai deserts when they lazed around in their tents during the heat of the summer days. In modern steel mills, those same fiery burning serpents, seraphim, can be observed in the blast furnaces when the temperature reaches a certain degree of white heat. They are a glowing red color, whereas the main fire is white. They resemble big fat lizards about 12 inches long. They are known to steel workers as fire lizards. The same fiery serpents are again observed in Isaiah 30 verse 6 and Deuteronomy 32 verse 24. However, the serpent is a snake. In the original manuscript, it is Zakel. The word can be used for snake, a worm, or to be afraid. In 2 Kings 18, verse 4, is the record of King Hezekiah destroying the brass thermometer made by Moses because the people still believed it contained life and was an object of worship to them. You see, I had often wondered this, ladies and gentlemen. I had often wondered why Yahweh would do such a thing, why he would tell Moses to put a snake. And Yeshua referred to that as well. But then when I saw that the Israelites were worshiping this in King Hezekiah's time, it also made me wonder why. Wonder why that Yahweh would create it, knowing that in the future they would be worshiping this thing. Well, one reason I can think of right away is he was looking for a king who would destroy such things. And King Hezekiah certainly stepped up to the plate. So, in 2 Kings 18:4, we'll start there again, is the record of King Hezekiah destroying the brass thermometer made by Moses because the people still believed it contained life and was an object of worship to them. In Psalms 140, verse 1, the word man is Adam in the original. It graphically shows the men of Israel's household are of the Adamic race. They had sharpened their tongues like a serpent, verse 3. That word sharpened is latash, or to instruct. The word serpent is nakash, and written with bars and dots to show that he is of Satan's race. Any instruction coming from that source is the philosophy of hate. It is denoted in the word poison, which is chema, or heat, fury, or anger. I'll have you know that it spoke of white heat here, right? Well, there was a movie, an old gangster movie called White Heat. Don't think it wasn't called that for a reason. James Cagney, I believe, was in that particular film. So they had sharpened their tongues like a serpent, verse 3. The word serpent is nakash, or written with the Baz and Dost to show he's of Satan's race. Any instruction coming from that source is the philosophy of hate. It is denoted in the word poison, which is chema, or heat, fury, or anger. The word adder is akashub, which is the female viper in Matthew 3:7 and correlating passages. She is Kali, the poisonous female of Jewry's beast system. You know who Kali is from India. Remember the Beatles movie? They worshipped Kali and they were trying to get that ring from Ringo's finger, remember? Kali. In Proverbs 23:32, the serpent and adder are the same as in Psalms 140 verse 3. The serpent in Proverbs 30:10, however, is the enchanting, quivering waves caused by rocks radiating the sun's heat. It is denoted by the word serpent is nakash, and written without bars and dots under the last two characters in the original Hebraic. In Ecclesiastes 10, verse 8 and 11, the serpent is nakash, written with the bars and dots to show he is of Satan's counterfeit race. It is further denoted in the word hedge in verse 8, which is gadar in the Hebraic. It means a wall as one's protection in the law. The word bite in both verses is nashak, or to lend upon usury. Surely the son of Satan will lend upon usury without enchantment. Verse 11. When one breaks the law, he loans on usury as our bail bond brokers. In Isaiah 62:25, the serpent is nakash and written with dots and bars to prove he is the cursed race of Jews, soon to be banished from Israel's Christian world. The wolf symbolizes people in the house of Israel who have not accepted Christ Jesus, whereas the lamb are those accepting him. The lion symbolizes the Lion of Judah, and the bullock symbolizes Ephraim, who is England. The straw which they are going to eat together is clean, uncontaminated peace. After the serpent race of Jews has been banished from Christendom to eat dust for the next 1,000 years. That word dust is afar, A-P-H-A-R, or rubbish, which will be the spiritual, mental, and material food of Jewry exiled out in Mongolia and Tibet, from whence his ancestral father Cain came when he went into the land of Nod, which means wandering in the Hebraic. What do you think, ladies and gentlemen? Kind of interesting, is it not? Let's continue. In Jeremiah 8:17, the serpents and cockatrices are the same counterfeit race of the devil. In Isaiah 14:29 is a prophecy for this era. The serpent is nakash and written with the bars and dots to prove he is of Satan's serpent race of Jews. Isaiah says its offspring would be a poisonous cockatrice, It was a female. During Isaiah's time, she was called Ishtar. Today, she has adopted her original Hindu name of Kali. She is the deadness in Jewry's blood system as the vampire of that counterfeit race. She is the adder in Psalms 58:3 and verse 4. The viper in Matthew 3:7, Matthew 12:34, Matthew 23:33, Luke 3:7. The woman in Zechariah 5:7 and Revelation 17:1-6, notwithstanding the Jew lie that the latter is the Roman Catholic Church. The serpent in Isaiah 14:29 was the Luciferian priesthood and Satan in Babylon from 721 to 330 BC. A relative of theirs exalted himself as God in India in 600 BC. He was the king of the Naga, or serpent race, in that land. You know, I want to mention something to you. Pastor Bob sent an email out about these families in India that have six digits on their hands and toes. You'd have to see these pictures. It's really strange, I must tell you. Now, they don't look like they're giants, but somehow they have six digits on their hands and toes. So, since time immemorial, the king of the serpent race has been the current eldest son of the eldest son of the original crown, Prince of Hell. He was worshipped as Lucifer, yet called God. The record of one exalting himself as God in 600 BC is the first secular record of an exaltation in India, whereas his record in the Hindu scriptures goes back around to about 3,500 BC, when Enoch of the Adamic line of Seth says in his messianic prophecy, Satan first came out of the dimension of the spirit, a counterfeit material beast, making his appearance amidst man, contrary to divine law. In Isaiah 14:29, it is so big that we have to stand at a distance to observe it from Psalm 58:3 and 4, through the book of Revelation to verify it by the serpent's own record. At this occasion, however, we will not dwell on Isaiah 14:29 any further than to observe the meaning of the Hebrew words which say, "Rejoice not, thou whole Palestine, because the rod of him that smote thee is broken. For out of the serpent's root shall come a cockatrice, and his or her fruit shall be a fiery flying serpent." The original for that word rod is shebet. It is a scepter. It is the original caduceus as the emblem of Kali's power, the emblem of witchcraft and or occult science. The first serpent is Nakash. It is written with bars and dots under the last two characters. Written thus, it proves he is of Satan's serpent race of Jew vampires. The word root is Sharesh, bottom. It is the bottomless pit of hell in the upside-down floor of the synagogue of Satan. The word cockatrice is Sepha, T-S-E-P-H-A. It is an adder or viper, which seems to be an ordinary snake. It would have been, if not connected, with Satan's serpent race. When connected with that race, we know that that cockatrice is the whoring mother spirit or the vampire condition of Jewry's bloodstream. The fruit of that cockatrice is peri. It means a branch. The word fiery is seraph, burning one. The word flying is uph, UPH, which is up. Isn't that interesting? UPH, flying. Up, up, and away. To be faint, to be wary, flee away, wax faint. The second serpent is Saraph, S-A-R-A-P-H, a burning, fiery, stinging. Yes, she will be a burning, fiery, stinging reptile. She is Kali, the prostituting, blood-drunk mother spirit of a race of religious cutthroats and murderers. As the material or masculine cockatrice, he is the Ashkenazim Khazar Jews in Christendom and the black Zuhu Jews of Asia, in whom the satanic force of the night-prowling vampire Kali, the female cockatrice of Jewry's serpent system. With that whoring spirit within them, they pretend to be faint, always weary because they are persecuted. To hear them tell it, just because they are unfortunate to be born Jews. And you have seen that, haven't you? How they look weary and weak from all this persecution that they've received. They don't look that same way when they're lording it over on you in a concentration camp, though. Very much different then. So, they flee from justified punishment when their sabotage and destruction smacks them in the face. They wax faint after every pogrom. But then they press on with one thought constantly burning within them, a fiery, stinging spirit, usually depraved sense of revenge against people who formerly gave them sanctuary out of pity. Now, isn't that funny? Because Germany, whom they want to wipe off the planet, was a people that took them in and treated them very well. America is another place that took them in and treated them very well. Let's read this part again. They wax very faint after a pogrom, but they press on with one thought constantly burning within them, a fiery, stinging spirit, spiritually depraved sense of revenge against people who formerly gave them sanctuary out of pity, refuse to bow to Jewry and lower themselves to his level, then surrender to that counterfeit race and permit it to rule supreme with its subjects clamped in the so-called benevolence of Talmudic slavery. Satan's serpent race bobs up again in Job 26. He is the same breed as the one in Isaiah 14:29. Another track is observed in Job 24 as the low chicanery of Satan's vampire race, whom Job calls he occasionally, and he is Satan as Bildad's god. Bildad and his companions are Cainite Sabine serpent mongrels. Very interesting. Another snake track is observed in Job's 25th chapter, where Bildad is praising Satan and condemning God. He says to Job, "How then can man be justified with God? So come on over to Satan's house, Job." His light of the Luciferian doctrine shines on all good men. God even looks with scorn on the moon and stars, but Satan is wiser. He worships them. How can God love a man who God looks on as a worm and the son of a worm? Very interesting. But Job answered and said, how hath you, Bildad, helped him that is without power? How save you the arm that has no strength? Dead things are formed from under the waters and from under the inhabitants thereof. That's Job 26, verse 1, 2, and 5. That compound word, dead things, is Rephaim. Again, we've seen that before, dead things, Rephaim, in the original Hebrew. It means the shades of spiritual and material death. It is twice dead serpent race of Jew. It is the twice dead serpent race of Jew vampires. See, it means shades. Now, I want to just point this out. I'm not into any of this new music or anything. But these dead people and the serpent race of Jews, it means shades, dead things. It means shades of spiritual and material death. Well, you know, have you ever heard of Slim Shady? You know that that's his alter ego, right? I forget the guy's name. He's a white rapper. Eminem. Now, his alter ego is Slim Shady. Are you digging what I'm telling you? Listen to this again now. That compound word, dead things, is Rephaim in the original Hebrew. It means the shades of spiritual and material death. It is the twice-dead serpent race of Jew vampires. In Job 25, the word dominion is mashal, to cause to rule. Fear is pashad, dread. Peace is shalom, favor. The high places is marom, a person in authority. Light is or, O-R, enlightened. Arise is kum, Q-U-M, abide. Thus Bildad says his God, the Jew race, causes fear to rule when a Jew favors one in authority. Jewry favors to man, then and now is preceded with the lowest form of servility. Bootlicking, then loaning money to an individual or a government so as to obligate them to him. When Satan, as a Jew, has obligated one of his beast system, his Luciferian doctrine ensures him that man's instinct to be honorable compels him to respond. That's just the same thing with gift giving. Do you understand what this gift giving is? Why the Bible tells you not to love gifts? See, if you take a gift, listen to what it just said right here. I'll read it again, but I'm going to just say this to you. When somebody gives you a gift, because they know that you are decent. Somebody gives you a gift, you feel obligated to give them something in return. Because it was one kind act deserves another. But listen here, okay? You see, if you were just giving a gift to another, one of your brothers, and they gave you a gift and there was nothing connected to that gift, it was just out of sheer love, there's nothing wrong with that kind of a gift. But there are people out here that will give you a gift, and they intend by giving you that gift, they're taking advantage of your good nature because they know you will feel obligated to them. They are doing this deliberately. That way, that's why we should not be lovers of gifts. So I'm going to read this again. Thus Bildad says his God, the Jew race, causes fear to rule when a Jew favors one in authority. Jew Jewry's favors to men, then and now, is preceded with the lowest form of servility, bootlicking, then loaning money to an individual or a government so as to obligate them to him. Get it? When Satan, as a Jew, has obligated one to his beast system, his Luciferian doctors, pay attention right here, listen. When Satan, as a Jew, has obligated one to his beast system, his Luciferian doctrine ensures him that man's instinct to be honorable compels him to respond. And inasmuch as the Jew seems so harmless, while being so meticulous in his duties, he is given a position of authority and trust. After securing that advantageous position, the Jew gradually puts forward hidden suggestions for various unnecessary projects which the superior non-Jew ultimately believes are necessary, and the initiative seems to be his. See, he's making it, the Jew convinces him that it's his own idea that this project should be done. Like, yes, it's a good idea for us to send our policemen over to Israel so that they can train them to abuse our citizens. Yes, that's a good idea. It's a good idea to have a central bank so that there won't be bank runs and problems, you see. Of course, I'm being sarcastic. You know that, right? So, again, after securing that advantageous position, the Jew gradually puts forward hidden suggestions. Subtle, the beast of the field, the most subtle beast of the field. Hidden suggestions for various unnecessary projects which the superior non-Jew ultimately believes are necessary, and the initiative seems to be his. The projects are started, and he unconsciously does the very bidding of the Jew, whose slithering chicanery gradually undermines the business until the damage is beyond repair before the superior wakes to what has occurred. Perhaps he trusts the Jew to such an extent that he will never awaken to the truth. He takes the responsibility as being negligent for permitting his business to decline, and he discovers he is denied further credit at the bank presided over by another Jew, secretly in league with the traitor in his office. Hello. I think I should read that to you again. I won't read the whole thing, but I want you to pay attention. This is how businesses are stolen. Think about what is being said here. So a Jew, it's basically saying a Jew grovels, you know, at this man in this business, and he grovels at his feet. He's a bootlicker and everything else. And he's real meticulous in his duties until he's given a position of authority and trust. And after getting this position, the Jew puts forth subtle suggestions for various unnecessary projects which his superior believes are necessary. You know, like things in companies, we need to make sure that nobody's being persecuted if they're a homosexual, or we need to make sure that more women have high positions. We need to make sure that blacks have high positions in companies. Even though they can't do the job, we can just pretend they do. I mean, after all, we as Jews, they would say, have contrived all kinds of realities. So if we can show you these successful blacks and show that to the other people, soon it will become a reality. This is unnecessary, but yet now the owner of the company believes it's necessary. It's now necessary to be politically correct. It's necessary to have a woman lord it over a man. Whether Yahweh says that shouldn't be the way it is or not, the Jew is forging the way here. So, once it says the projects are started, and he unconsciously undermines the business until damage is beyond repair before the superior awakens to what has occurred. Perhaps he trusts the Jew to the extent that he will never awaken to the truth. I know a company like this right now. I see a Jew that's encroaching on this company. He's already gotten control of the money. He's already got control of the operations. And he's got four different titles. And this guy who's a Christian who owns the company thinks that Jews can be Christians and be saved. This Jew is smiling all the way, and soon it will be his company. As time goes on, this man is allowing this man to put forth all kinds of governmental things that they have no business doing. And all of a sudden, there's all kinds of Jew names showing up in the company. And pretty soon, this man won't even be part of the company. He takes the responsibility as being negligent, the superior, that is, for permitting his business to decline, and he discovers he is denied further credit at the bank presided over by another Jew, secretly in league with the traitor in his office. Satan then offers to reciprocate the former favors he received and offers to buy one's business in apparent sincere efforts to prevent one from becoming a total failure. One has no alternative. The offer is generous. One accepts the offer, and one's work created out of one's genius passes into the parasitical hands of the blood-sucking vampire, who then goes to his brother Jew in the bank to refinance the business for speculative purposes. The traitorous beast then sells the property at an enormous profit, while his former employer commits suicide because he believes he is a failure. The traitor and his banker brother then divide the loot between themselves in accordance with Lucifer's law in the Shulchan Aruch section of the Talmud. It's either Shulchan Aruch section of the Talmud, whatever, which says, when a Jew makes a deal with a non-Jew and another Jew comes up and deceives the non-Jew, no matter in what manner, whether he gives him false measure or overcharges him, then both Jews must share between them the profits thus sent by Yahweh. But it's written Jehovah here. Ladies and gentlemen, you've just seen how it's done. I hope you heard that. I'll explain a little bit. You see, they've got a Jew inside the company, and they've got a Jew financier outside of the company. They want this company. Now, they can also just go to the Federal Reserve and buy it outright. Just go print up the money and buy it outright. That was done many a time. But this Jew would go into the company to infiltrate it. He'd be a bootlicker, very meticulous, smiling all the while. Then all of a sudden, he's given a higher position. Then he wants to start implementing programs and gets the owner of that business to believe that that's the way it should be, and that these ideas are his own. Soon, as the Jew always does, because the Jew is not capable of running the world or running a government or running an agency or running anything, the business begins to fail. When the business owner goes outside the business to his Jew friend to get some money, the banker denies him. Pretty soon, the Jew who was licking his boots offers him to buy his business, offers to bail him out. You can get out of this without shame. So, the non-Jew gets out of the business that he created from nothing. And then the two Jews divvy up everything, and this man is left with nothing. Ladies and gentlemen, I suggest you think on that for quite some time. Bringing a Jew into your business is like bringing a Jew into your country. Bringing a Jew into your church is like bringing a Jew into your business. Bringing a Jew anywhere in your life, you will find that aspect of your life will soon be destroyed. You know, I get a real kick out of some people out there on the internet. I just had some, went out and posted a comment on a video, and some guy says, "What does this have to do with the Jews?" And I said, "It has everything to do with the Jews," and I explained a few things. And then he wrote me back and he said, "The only difference between the Christians and the Jews are the Old Testament and the New Testament. This is what you're dealing with out in this world. See, they just can't see it. I don't know why they can't see it. They love those Jews and they will stand up for those Jews and the blacks and everything else. I've seen recently in my life champions of multiculturalism. Oh, they want to be friends with everybody. And they go out of their way to do it. They have no idea what's coming their way. I just don't understand people, how they cannot see. I had another person say to me, you know, I'm not an Israelite and I can see it. And when I try to convince the Israelites, they won't listen. They can't understand it. Well, I told them we have a curse upon us. That's the only answer I can come up with to even answer my own question. You understand? There is a curse that does not allow these people to see the truth. So, let's go on from here. On other occasions, when one becomes obligated to a Jew in any manner, and he learns one's weakness or discovers a secret which one is ashamed of and is desirous of keeping it out of public cognizance, one is then in the power of the Luciferian reptile. You see, this is the very thing that the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion talks about. Making sure that everybody that's involved in the press and in politics, that they would have something on them. You understand? This is how they control. It's a control mechanism. Information is used to control. Money is used to control. So both money and information would be used to control anybody that's in the press or anybody that's in the government. Therefore they could just reveal that at any time if the person gets out of hand. And further along with that, they will threaten their family to keep them in line. See, blackmail is a deep, deep thing. Blackmail, see? Black. The color black is a warning. You say, the Jew tells you, don't look at people's color. Don't look at people's race. Don't look at people's religion. You know why? Because when you look at their religion, you find out that their God is Lucifer, as I told you last week. And then when you look at their race, you find out all the things that they're doing. There was a man in Italy that was washing his butthole, let's say. I'm not going to say the word. He's washing his ass in public from a dripping fountain. And he sticks his hand and washes his ass with his right hand. And then from the same hand, he gets some water in it and drinks out of his hand. Hello? Are you hearing me? Sorry for the crudeness, but you just have to see what these people are about. Don't feel guilty that they're not equal with you. They're not even in the same ballpark as you. They're not equal to you in any way whatever. I don't care if they can beat you with a club to the ground. A gorilla can beat you to the ground. An elephant could beat you to the ground. That doesn't make them equal with you. Don't feel guilty about that. Now, back to the color. Colors are warnings in nature. Certain birds won't eat certain insects, and so on and so forth. In nature, colors are warning signs. Blackmail. Black. Don't you notice that the darker the race gets, that the more violent gets? Or is that just my perception? Let me ask you, do you see it that way? Of course, it doesn't go for the Jew, because the Jew is race mixed with every race, so they transcend that particular theory. However, when you look at the races, to me, they just get worse and worse as the color deepens. I wouldn't say the Mexicans are as bad as the blacks, not even close. Yet they're, you know, you understand what I mean? It's a warning. When I see a lot of these blacks, they look absolutely like scary. I mean, like spooky. They used to call them spooks, because they really are scary. You see, you don't realize that because you've been seeing those faces for so long that you're not scared by them anymore. But if you were to take a real look at many of them, you'd realize, whoa, those are scary. If you ever saw that, you know, in a dream, you'd be jumping. You know what I mean? Now, you take that however you want that, but I'm telling you that if you don't agree with me, I think you're a liar. So let's go on from here. On other occasions, when one becomes obligated to a Jew in any manner, and he learns one's weakness, or discovers a secret which one is ashamed of. See, love covers, right? Doesn't the Bible tell you love covers? If you found something, a weakness about one of your brothers or something like that, or you wouldn't go shouting it out, right? You'd cover it because you love your brother. You'd cover his weakness or whatever he was ashamed of. People do things they didn't, you know, necessarily want to do, or might have just happened to them, right? But of course, the Jew is a different different than you. They don't think like you and I do. See, they use that as a weapon against somebody. On the other occasions, when one becomes obligated to a Jew in any manner, and he learns one's weakness or discovers a secret which one is ashamed of and is desirous of keeping it out of the public cognizance, one is then in the power of the Luciferian reptile. When the superior awakens to the chicanery and takes measure to divest himself of the crawly influence, the Jew bears his poisonous serpent fangs and bodily demands to be given supreme power, or he will expose the secret to public view. If the superior defies the Jew, the latter very piously gives information about the secret to the newspapers, which are run by his own people, of course. In what he declares is service to the public. Another Jew then broadcasts it over the radio so as to kill the confidence of the public in the victim. The blind public does the rest and throws the good man out of office and destroys his public usefulness, while the hypocritical blackmailing Jew is held up as a public benefactor. Are you hearing? Are you paying attention? Do you want to know how your enemy operates? You are learning right now, ladies and gentlemen, just how your enemy operates. I suggest you listen to this recording several times to make sure that you begin to understand how this enemy operates. Now, these people are mentally ill. You do realize that, right? And you do realize that they have confidence problems. Oh, they can act like they have confidence, but once you just take a little chisel and chip away a couple of things, you can destroy them in no time. You've got to be on the offensive. So let's see what else is said here. When Satan has accomplished his dirty work, he then slithers into the vacant chair to suck his living out of our people, as if the occasion warrants it. If, however, it is not expedient for him to take the chair at that time, he suggests to another superior, non-Jews, that a certain man, a non-Jew, is more capable than him to discharge the duties of the office. In that manner, Satan remains in the darkness behind the certain man, who is always of weak character and submits to the Jew's very bidding out of fear of losing his well-paid job or of being character assassinated. Now, remember I told you about the externalization of the hierarchy? And you remember that I told you about the Jew is usually, or their father, usually is the invisible remaining in the background while they put out the character to take the heat, which is usually a Shabbos Goy race trader. Or these days, it could be somebody of any race. You see? In respect to Satan getting peace in high places in our government and nation, Dean Acheson, Secretary of State, you've heard of him, and President Harry S. Truman, who is a Jew, are the certain men of whose sponsored conspiracy Senator Joseph McCarthy speaks of in the Congressional Record for 14 March 1951. Mr. Owen Lattimore, the State Department's advisor, praised the State Department for having succeeded in allowing China to fall to the communists. Of course, without letting it appear to the world that we had shoved it. See, we have been spreading communism. This is something that I have talked about with many people, and it shuts their mouth very quickly. I say to them, after we've been involved in wars, whether it's World War One, let's say World War Two, what happened in China, Korea, Vietnam, etc., has communism been decimated, or has it been advanced or augmented? And of course, at that point, they can say nothing, because we all know that wherever we have stepped ground in this country, we have promoted communism. That communism has moved forward. The very thing Hitler was trying to stop is the very thing the Jews would not allow to stop. And they use their control in this country and in Britain, and of course in Russia, to make sure that communism moved forward. So you can see now that we have... See, China wasn't going to be communist, you understand? The people here made sure, in this country, the Jews here, made sure that it came out communist. So that they could have Stalin go in there and teach Mao Zedong how to kill all those people that he killed. Yes, Mao Zedong loved Stalin. Mao Zedong was an idiot. An incompetent idiot. Yet he was worshipped as a god. And he killed millions and millions. Notice that whenever communism gets in, millions are killed. Ladies and gentlemen, let me read this now. Let's read what he said again, okay? Mr. Owen Lattimore, Jew, the State Department's advisor, praised the State Department for having succeeded in allowing China to fall to the communists without letting it appear to the world that we had shoved it. It is almost incredible, but it is a matter of record. He then goes on to say, the thing to do, therefore, is also let South Korea fall, but do not let it be known that we pushed her. Hence the recommendation for a parting grant of $150 million. The picture of Western Europe, Mr. President, is much the same. We are preparing to allow Western Europe to fall without having it appear that we pushed her. In other words, the present plan is strictly a phony plan for a phony defense, a case of those in the back rooms where the planning is done by the same crowd that did the planning for China, saying the same thing said about China, namely, we will let them fall, but we will not let it appear that we pushed them. You see, I told you that Germany, the tribe of Judah, was the last bastion for Europe. There was nobody else that would be able to defend Europe. This is one of the main reasons why the Jews wanted to destroy Germany. Germany must be destroyed. You remember the book, right? If you didn't hear that when I read that to you, I suggest that you get a hold of that book, Germany Must Perish. I also suggest that you look up the Morgenthau Plan. But yes, you see, Germany would have defended all of Europe. That's exactly what they were doing. They weren't trying to take over the world. What they were trying to do is defend the world from communism. And when we got involved, that's when Germany was defeated. We killed our own brothers and sisters. We firebombed our own brothers and sisters. and holocausted them for the Jew to ensure that we would be slaves in our own countries, to ensure that communism would move forward. I hope you do realize that that's exactly what happened. That is exactly what happened. So when you look at Hitler and you're telling me how evil he is and how there was gun control in Germany, which is a load of crap, and how Hitler was an occultist and all these things, sorry, Charlie, you're going to have to do better than that. I've studied into World War II Germany, and I know exactly what the purpose of Germany was. So let's move on. In a cafe in Budapest, Hungary, in 1919, the Jew Jacob H. Schiff, he was over here, by the way, Jacob Schiff. He's the one that sent the gold to the ship to help the Bolshevik Revolution. Jacob Schiff is one of the Rothschilds' main men here in America. He ensured much destruction here. He's the one that made sure Woodrow Wilson was paying to keep the Russian Jews alive through the winters and so on and so forth. In a cafe in Budapest, Hungary, 1919, Jew Jacob H. Schiff revealed another phase of the beast system. It was published in the book Geneva Against Peace by Comte de Saint-Hilaire in 1936, which he quotes Schiff. And I talked about this book before because I went and looked it up. The health of our golden calf, note the Jew, god of gold, demands that certain nations should be sick. Listen very careful. Remember I told you this a long time ago that we need another sick man? Remember that? Here's the evidence of it again. Let's listen. The health of our golden calf, he's a Jew, demands that certain nations should be sick, namely those not of themselves to develop. Take, for example, pre-war Turkey. The sick man, is it was called, by diplomats, which helped to keep us healthy. From it, we received concessions of every description. By the way, when we talk about diplomats and we talk about ambassadors to other countries, those are the part of the Kahila, by the way. I want you to understand that. Remember the scribes and the mutes and all that stuff that we spoke about in part one? Well, these ambassadors and these people that, like I just said, these are those people. They are part of the Kahila. So, take, for example, pre-war Turkey, the sick man, as it was called by diplomats, which helped to keep us healthy. From it, we received concessions of every description. Pay attention, please. Banks, this is what they received from the sick man. Banks, mines, harbors, railroads, etc. In short, its whole economical life was in our care. See, when you're in the Jews' care, you become the sick man. That's what he's telling you. When the Jew is in your country, it is a parasite. It is an admitted parasitical people. When you are in the care of a Jew doctor, when you are in the care of a Jew lawyer, when you are in the care of a Jew judge, when you are in the care of a Jew baby killer abortionist, when you are in the care of a Jew dentist, you will be a sick man. It's admitted right here. Listen. Take, for example, pre-war Turkey, the sick man, as it was called by diplomats, which helped to keep us healthy. That's the Jews. From it, we received concessions of every description. Banks, mines, harbors, railroads, etc. In short, its whole economical life was in our care. And we cared for it so well that it died. In Europe, at least. See, listen, we cared for it so well that it died, these Jews are saying. Now that the accumulation of Turkey's wealth has become common property in the international Jew banking house of Rothschild, and that we have the fulfillment of our mission at hand of revealing to Christendom the fact that Jewry is Satan, and that reestablishing the world empire of Satan, we need another sick man. This alone would have been sufficient reason, apart from higher consideration of annihilation of Christianity, for grafting Bolshevism onto Tsarist Russia. Russia is now the sick man of the post-war days, and it is much more nourishing than the Ottoman Empire, which were the Turks, which was Germany's ally, which the Turks held Palestine. It also does less in its own defense. It, the god of gold, is now ready for another feast. Soon Russia will be a corpse, and we shall have nothing left to do but cut it up. Even if a few drops of blood were spilled in the process, we Jews have no cause to get excited. A few drops of blood spilled in Jewry's efforts to annihilate Christendom. Pardon me for one second. I switched the page by accident. A few drops of blood spilled in Jewry's efforts to annihilate Christianity. The record shows Jewry is directly responsible for the death in wars, mass murders, and deliberate starvation of more than 144 million people in the last 38 years. Hello! Did you just hear that? I told you we lost 2/3 of our race in about 150 years. 144 million mass murders in these wars in 38 years. Let me read it again. A few drops of blood spilled in Jewry's efforts to annihilate Christianity. The record shows Jewry is directly responsible for the death in wars, mass murders, in deliberate starvation of more than 144 million people in the last 38 years. Now, I will show you where some of that starvation was done. Remember what I told you about in the Bolshevik Revolution, how they took the farms away from the people and they gave them one potato per family to eat per week? Meanwhile, the people of the world had sent them trains full of food, and instead of giving it to those Russian people, they put the food in warehouses and didn't give it to them and let them starve to death. Well, just in case you haven't heard me explain this already, when the Jews orchestrated the crash of 1929 in America, the Depression hit, and many of our people died. And the same thing happened. The world sent food our way, and the Jews stored it in warehouses and did not give it to the hungry. Ladies and gentlemen, you do not know what you're dealing with. You have no idea. When you hear me, you're thinking, oh, all the stupid things they taught you to think. You better start thinking outside the Jew box. Let's continue. We're almost out of time for today, but this is very nourishing. When Adolf Hitler began attracting attention beyond Germany with his anti-Jewishness, the Jew Kahilla in America selected James P. Warburg of Kuhn and Loeb and Company to finance him so as to build up a nationalist Germany and then push Anglo-Saxondom into attacking Germany and thus break the back of Christianity in Central Europe so as to pave the way for Jewry to seize all of Europe in the name of Russia and in the final prelude to the destruction of the white race and the establishing of Satan's world empire. Just like I told you, Germany was the last bastion, not only militarily, but Christian-wise as well. So was Russia. And now America. Major Robert H. Williams reported in his Williams Intelligence Summary for February 1950 about James P. Warburg's, who's a Jew, of course, part in the plot against Christendom. He says, last November, the widow of the late General Ludendorff, on trial at Nuremberg, explained why her husband broke with Hitler, confirmed the reports in convincing details. She stated, as early as the summer of 1929, James P. Warburg had undertaken an assignment from financial circles in America, which desired to exercise solitary influence on Germany in the unleashing of a national revolution. Warburg's task was to find the suitable man in Germany, and he entered into contract with Adolf Hitler, who subsequently received sums of money amounting to $27 million up to January 30th, 1932, and still another $7 million thereafter, enabling him to finance his movement. Remember, though, see, you're thinking of this as Hitler is working with the Jews against society. That's not what happened. Hitler needed money. Remember that Germany was definitely destitute. And this Jew probably presented to him the idea that he would help finance Germany to get it back on its feet. Better take a look at things and look at them a little differently than you might think. Let's see what else it says, though. After 1919, German Revolution, Jewry took over the country, lock, stock, and barrel. Jewry retained another trick. Jewry retained power until Hitler came on the scene. Then why was international Jewry so anxious to foment a nationalist revolution in Germany? Because they desired to destroy the royal Judah tribe of Israel, the Nordic Germans, because Jewry could not absorb them in mongrelization and to destroy Christianity in Central Europe. After Adolf Hitler received the financial assistance, he disenfranchised the Jews in Germany, then set up a... See, he was doing this for his own purpose. And the purpose of the German nation. He wasn't doing this because he thought he was... I just don't believe that. Let's see what it says, though. Let's go on here. So he got rid of the Jews, which is the secret of how Germany rose in power. Because with the Jews in their nation, it never would have happened. Well, I am running out of time. I don't know. I think we'll stop right there. We're on page 24 and right in the middle. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm enjoying this series. I hope that you are paying attention. I hope that you are learning something. I hope that I am, or Yahweh is imparting to you through me and through this man's life, who the enemy is, who the enemy wants to destroy, how they go about it, and just the proof that they are not who they say they are. We're living in a crazy world right now. It's not a lot of fun to be dealing with these Jews. The world was a better place when they were locked up on the streets at night. Unfortunately, we're in the time of Jacob's trouble. Or fortunately, depending on how you look at it. If this is what it takes to wake our brothers and sisters, then perhaps this is what needs to be done. In the search for the truth, I find that many people will come to a point where they're offended. Well, that's, I can't help that. You see, when you search through the truth and you find out things, you're not always going to like what you find out. Yet you've got to keep forging through and foraging through. I had an Italian listener of mine say that, you know, I hurt his feelings because I told him about Sicily. Well, if you know you don't have Jew blood, what are you worried about? I never said that every Sicilian is race mixed, but I said that a great deal of them are, especially the ones that came over here from the mafia and formed the underground for the Jews. They are Jews. If you don't like that, I can't help that. If you don't like my revealing of the truth, I can't help it. Don't listen anymore. I mean, what can I really do? I mean, I'm just going to show it as I find it. Wouldn't you do the same? I don't know. I'm sorry if you feel that way, but someday I might find out something about myself. Who knows? You know, I found out there's things you find out about yourself you don't like either when you look through the truth. So, I mean, hey, that's the way it is. You just got to, I love the truth no matter what. And you should too. You've been listening to Saxon's Creed Radio Show. I'm David James. And until next time, study to show thyself approved.